Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming on. Sorry we're a fraction late. We just had our annual meeting and we're all being a bit late, and one of our guests just walked out.
It's only nine, don't worry.
I know, but where's she gone? So it's been a busy day, and of course we've got our annual dinner tomorrow with 900 people coming, so that's a busy time. But because of the importance of, with the Prime Minister of course, because of the importance of Schillinger's story, Anne and I thought it'd be great if she could come along and talk about it. It's not so long since she was here when Schillinger spoke about her book Triumph of the Airheads and the Retired from Common Sense, which caused a lot of interest and made an interesting paper. But in view of the controversy about Ishmael Beer, we thought it would be great for her to come along and just document what happened. She can put it on her website, she can put it on our website, we'll publish it in the Sydney papers just to set the record straight. So I will introduce our speaker very briefly, as we're running a little bit behind time. Schillinger, of course, is a journalist, a commentator, and an author. And she's here tonight to talk about the current controversy she's engaged herself in, and a very interesting controversy. And the topic of the talk is Chasing Ishmael Beer, Truth, Racism, the US Media, and Blockbuster Publishing. Sounds like a good menu. Many thanks, Schillinger.
Thank you very much for coming along to this afternoon and to hear the story of an investigation. Before I begin, I want to say that this is quite a complex story with quite a cast of characters, and I have simplified it as much as I can, and I've ruthlessly eliminated people, but there's still a cast of about six that you need to listen to, and so I'm going to warn you, do listen to the names, otherwise you're going to be like those people in the cinema who go, which one's Joseph? Or they go, I thought that was the hero. Anyhow, just to say that ahead. I have, as I said, I've simplified it to make it as simple as I can, but like all good stories are always made up of layers. And all like all the best mysteries, this story starts off with just one thing going wrong. It was an email, a clumsily worded email that set off this whole investigation. The tale of how child soldier Ishmael Beer and his memoirs, a long way gone, have got to where they are now is simply because someone sent the wrong email. And the truth is that stories like this very rarely begin because of something big, because of a major event. Instead, they begin because something very, very small goes wrong or comes to someone's attention. It just strikes the wrong note, and that prompts curiosity. And that then sets off other reactions and events far greater than anyone could have visualised at the beginning. It's like spilling a glass of red wine on a white tablecloth. You can't believe what a huge splash it makes and how far the drops go. And very often when the people involved look back and remember that one tiny thing that went wrong, they think, if only we hadn't done that, if only we'd fixed that. I like the Aesop's fable quality of all this, the sense that although humans are the most deceitful species on earth, and we all at times practice deception, sometimes for good reasons as well as bad, we know we labour under a kind of natural law that our deceitful actions will almost certainly come back to bite us on the bum. And when I think about this investigation into the veracity of Ishmael Beer's memoirs, an investigation that began with me sitting in a small attic office in East Sydney, which the Australian newspaper then committed to, putting on two of its own reporters, which has now made the cover of one of America's most well-read journals, an investigation which is now quoted regularly on blogs and in interviews around the world, an investigation which, by the way, has led to my two newspaper colleagues, David Nason, Peter Wilson and myself, being called effing muckraking hacks on a website read by millions of people. And I have to say, we're actually very staid. We're very drearily diligent. So we're thinking of having that quite racy epithet printed on some T-shirts. When I think about all of this, I like to also think that there might be now a few high-powered, high-profile New Yorkers thinking, if only that email hadn't been sent, then maybe Ishmael Beer's best-selling tale of his descent into hell, followed by redemption and a new life in America, would not have been revealed to be at best a book with key errors and exaggerations, or at worst, a book that contains many fabrications. Up until our stories broke in January, there had been very little criticism or close questioning of Beer's story, of how at 12 he became caught up in Sierra Leone's terrible civil war that lasted from 1991 to 2002, of how he saw his parents supposedly being murdered, and how he was then forced to dodge death as a child on the run before being dragooned into the Sierra Leonean army, and then turned into a 13-year-old killing machine high on cocaine and dope and driven by a need for revenge. The civil war in this small West African country might have started with a bunch of youthful, ideologically driven rebels taking on a corrupt and weak administration, but it soon dissolved into a war about diamonds, about greed and control. Villagers were killed indiscriminately. Tens of thousands were murdered. Limbs, hands, feet, ears, lips were hacked off in terror campaigns. A third of the population was displaced, and children were forced to fight on both sides. A Sierra Leone refugee said to me the other day that the war went over any boundaries you can imagine. He said it affected every village, every town, everyone suffered. In one passage of his book, Beer describes the expression in the eyes of captured and bound rebel soldiers just before he shot them, how their eyes gave up hope. Now, it's that kind of observation which has garnered this book ecstatic reviews from around the world, from the Washington Post, The Guardian, Time Magazine, Newsweek, The New York Times, The Christian Science Monitor, Entertainment Weekly, it just goes on. The Washington Post declared, "Everyone in the world should read this book." TV host Jon Stewart said in an interview that reading the book had made his heart hurt. So our investigation from Australia, which has dared to point out that there were major discrepancies between the book and what witnesses and records actually reveal, has caused an embarrassing ruckus, and one which has become ugly as a result. Basically, it's us, the reporters on one side, throwing, I suppose, a bucket of cold water on some of the book's more sensational claims and incidents, and on the other side, a Beer's American publisher and editor, Sarah Crichton, who has her own imprint at the very important publishing house Farrar, Straus & Giroux, Beer's agent, Ira Silverberg, and the woman who has become Beer's unofficial guardian in New York, Laura Sims. Oh, and you can also throw in UNICEF, although even UNICEF has had to acknowledge that there are problems with the book. The dispute has also been picked up in the blogosphere, with interested bystanders joining in on either side. Beer's admirers are pretty fierce, too, in their appreciation of this young, charismatic writer. We could never get an interview with him. We could never get any access. And so at one stage, Peter Wilson went to a talk given by Beer in London just so he could ask some tough questions. And he had to do it in front of 100 adoring fans. And I said to him afterwards, feeling for him, "What was that like? How do they all treat you?" And I could hear the Cockney photographer saying in the background, "Like a rattlesnake in a picnic lunch." So what is it about this story that made us pursue it? What mattered to me? What mattered to the Australian? Well, first, there's some basic issues here that affect us all. Most generally, does a memoir have to be as truthful as, say, an autobiography or a biography? What responsibility does the publisher bear for the truth of a non-fiction book? What is owed to readers? And there's been another element. To what extent has this controversy and how it's been received been affected by race? And I'm not just talking about Ishmael's race, I'm talking about our Australian status as well, given that Ishmael Beer is a darling of America. And that leads to another question. Was this young man encouraged by the people around him in America to exaggerate and make his story more gripping for Western readers? Or did he even do it himself to win our attention? Because given what he has come out of, given the horrors of the Sierra Leonean Civil War, just watch the opening scenes of Blood Diamond, for instance, or better still, the documentary Darkness Over Paradise, which was made here by some refugee Sierra Leonean journalists. If you look at all of that and think of that, that would be obscene. Are we saying that a young boy can be caught up in all of that and it's still not enough for our Western tastes? He has to embroider his story in order to make it sell? What are we? A bunch of Romans watching African gladiators in the Colosseum, and your battle's not enough, bring in the lions and the crocodiles? And there's the final question, does truth matter? Especially now people feel almost embarrassed by the word truth and insist on sticking those quote marks around it. Now, it's not at all surprising that there are things in Beer's book that don't match up with reality. After all, he was a young kid. He was on drugs and confronted every day with the kinds of horrors that the rest of us might only see in a slasher movie. And in this mayhem, Beer certainly wasn't travelling with a notebook. But the trouble is that the publisher and the 27-year-old author refused to countenance any suggestion that the memoir is less than factually honest and that it might need a gentle disclaimer up front. What's more, Beer has always claimed that he has a photographic memory to justify the way he includes precise conversations and the most minute details. And so our investigation has had to continue. So, what was this email, this small thing, this bit of irritating grit in the shoe? It was 300 words long, and it was sent last November from New York. It's hastily written, accusatory, slightly threatening, and it got right up the nose of the people to whom it was sent. A comfortable, middle-aged couple from Busselton on WA's south coast. Their names are Bob and Peter Lloyd. They're in their 50s, and while they now own a bookshop in Busselton, their background is the mining industry. They've lived everywhere from Botswana to Vietnam and Siberia. Now, last July, Bob was headhunted to take over as general manager of a mine in the southern province of Sierra Leone. And to his amazement, because at the time he was reading an advanced copy of A Long Way Gone, which was about to come out in Australia, he found himself at the very mine where Ishmael Beer's father had worked before the war, and near where Ishmael had his idyllic childhood growing up in the small village of Mogweno. Even more astonishing, he seemed to have found Ishmael's father, Joseph, alive and well, actually working in the laboratory at the mine. Now, Ishmael Beer is supposed to be the most famous orphan on earth. So when this unfortunately worded email hit the Lloyd's computers, they were already pretty twitchy, because for the previous several weeks, they had been trying to contact young Ishmael with their startling news. They truly thought that they were doing a good thing. But whoever they approached, first HarperCollins here in Australia, who are the local distributors for the book, then Farrar, Straus and Giroux, where Bob eventually got to talk to Sarah Crichton, they couldn't seem to get anywhere. It was really odd. And this hostile email was the last straw. It was signed in the name of Laura Sims, Beer's adopted mother. And what particularly frustrated the Lloyds was that from their reading of the book and having seen Beer interviewed, they really admired him. And now they were the ones being treated like rattlesnakes. And it's true that Ishmael Beer has done many admirable things. With his book, interviews and talks, he has helped focus attention on the plight of the 300,000 or so child soldiers caught up in wars in Africa and Asia and South America. Last November, UNICEF appointed him as their first advocate for children affected by war. He also sits on a children's rights committee advising Human Rights Watch, and he started the Ishmael Beer Foundation to raise money for other child soldiers. Tragically, the worst thing that happens to these kids is that after they have been rescued and rehabilitated, they often have so few prospects because of poverty, lack of education and training, or just massive unemployment in their own countries, that they go back to being soldiers, mercenaries, all over again. At least there they get paid. They have a structure. They have camaraderie. And these kids often can't go home because their families have disowned them because of the terrible things they've done. Sometimes you can read accounts of how young children have had to kill their brothers or their sisters or force their father to rape their mother, rape the sister, or rape the grandmother. They were forced to do horrific things. So their lives and souls have been plundered. Now, Beer's own story offers much more hope. It's not just about a descent into humanity. It's about salvation. Because after his 2 years in the army, Beer writes, he was handed over to UNICEF in January 1996 and sent to a rehabilitation camp. He then goes to a UN conference in New York, and there he meets this extraordinary woman, Laura Sims, who's a professional storyteller and activist. And later, she helps him get out of Sierra Leone and gets him over to Manhattan. She becomes his unofficial guardian, and then she sends him to school and later to college in Ohio. And this is where he first starts writing his memoir. Although, interestingly, at that stage, he is writing it as fiction, as short stories in a creative writing class. And he never dreams, he says, that his writing will end up being published. So when he does eventually find a publisher a few years later, and then A Long Way Gone comes out in the United States in early 2007, it debuts at number 2 in the New York Times bestsellers list and it makes beer, this dirt poor kid from Sierra Leone, a millionaire. 80% of his countrymen live on less than a dollar a day. So this is dizzily inspiring. Beer's story is truly the American dream. Now, there have been other books about child soldiers before. There's been David Eggers' novel, What is the What? There was Beasts of No Nation by the Nigerian Azadinma Awila, and Moses, Citizen and Me by Delia Jarrett McCauley. But what captured attention this time, what got the headlines, was that Ishmael Beer was relating his true life story. This wasn't fiction. These terrible events had actually happened to him, he said, and he had still saved himself. It's now sold over 700,000 copies, and that figure will soar. It'll go into the millions this coming August when the paperback is finally released in the US. They've only had the hardback so far, and that's where the bulk of sales have been. Now, Ishmael Beer continues to give interviews, to appear on TV shows and to give lectures and perform book readings, except there's one big difference now. When I first went to his website late last year, it listed his upcoming events, presumably so that fans could make sure they went along. Not anymore. Mysteriously, since the Australians' investigation started, the listing has been kept blank. When in January Ishmael Beer spoke in front of the Oxford Union, which calls itself the most prestigious debating society in the world, and, quote, it's a society aiming to promote debate and discussion across the globe, press were barred. Peter Wilson, who had gone along, was told that Beer's publisher in Britain, and here HarperCollins, had requested the band to, quote, keep out a troublesome reporter. And while Beer is used to giving hundreds of interviews, when the Village Voice recently decided to do a 6,000-word cover story on him, his book, and our investigation and our allegations, using a journalist who had been a Pulitzer Prize-winning finalist, he refused to give an interview, as did his publisher and editor, Sarah Crichton. And the terrible thing is that back in last November, the Lloyds had never intended any of this hoo-ha to happen. Certainly they'd never intended to go anywhere near the media. That wasn't their style. They just wanted someone to listen politely to what they had to say about the existence of this man called Joseph, who said he was Ishmael's father. Oh, and they had noticed something else. Bob said in one early and lengthy email to Laura Sims that went sent on November the 11th, the chronology in Beer's book doesn't seem right. The timeline's out. The events Ishmael described had happened 2 years later, in 1995, not 1993, as Beer had it. And said Bob helpfully, Joseph's story of the war is quite different from the story in the book. Now, I can only imagine, in retrospect, the effect of that aside as that email was read in New York. 2 years might not sound like much. I still actually think it's probably about 2005, not 2008 for it myself. But for this book, 2 years makes all the difference. In his book, on the second page, Ishmael says, the war came to him in January 1993 when he was 12, when there was a rebel invasion of first the Sierra Rutile mine where his father worked and the surrounding villages, Mogwemo, Kabati, and then a few weeks later, the bigger township of Matrujong, where Beer actually was at the time. It was this series of attacks that he describes that sent him hurtling towards his dreadful existence in the army. But said Bob, the locals told him all that had happened in January 1995. It had happened just like that, but not in 1993. Now, in his book, Beer wanders the country for almost a year as a civilian refugee. He has a birthday before going into the army, which makes it at least November. His birthday is in the middle of November. And then he enters the rehab camp in January 1996. So if the attack happened in 1995, not 1993, then Beer can't have been in the army for 2 years, more like 2 months. The real date also means that Ishmael would have been 14, not 12, when he was forced on the road and lost his family, and 15, not the much more emotive and childlike 13, when he was forced into the army. Now, I'm not saying that 15 isn't ghastly and that 2 months isn't shocking, but in terms of marketing and PR, a 15-year-old who fights for 2 months doesn't have the power factor of a 13-year-old fighting for 2 years. So this extra material about the date being wrong, which was just two sentences in Bob's long email, must have come as a jolt to somebody. After that, Bob and Peter didn't hear anything for many, many days until Bob sent a reminder email, and then this 300-word email I've been describing arrived. It seemed to accuse the Lloyds of possibly being dishonest or people out to make trouble. Why are you getting in touch at this time, it asked. Is there something that you want? And it warned the Lloyds that they shouldn't talk to anyone else. It said, We are deeply concerned that this issue not go further than you, Sarah, that's Sarah Crichton, and myself. This email is also oddly phrased. It has strange syntax to it. It has wording like this, quote, "Why you said in my letter that this man came to you, and why you told Sarah that you sought out the boy's father, and why you were passionate about reaching him. It's quite different from two other emails I've seen, which have also been signed Laura Sims. The truth is, it reads as if it has been written by someone whose native language is not English. And when I emailed Laura Sims about this, asking her to confirm that she had written this second email, she didn't reply. Anyhow, the combined effect, the perceived rudeness, the jangling language, was just enough, too much for the lawyer to push them over the edge, and they ended up, through another series of coincidences, talking to me. And I have to say that originally, I went into it thinking, oh, this must be a bit of confusion here. Maybe Bob and Peter haven't expressed themselves clearly to the publishers. So I rang them, and then suddenly I was the rattlesnake. I walked into the same wall of hostility, resentment, dismissiveness, and plain rudeness. And I was really surprised, because I could imagine that the father angle might have been off-putting, you know, even seemingly insensitive, but why didn't these people want to know about this crucial date? Because it changed everything in the book. Now, the issue of fact-checking things like dates or the soundness of someone's story is a bit of a sore point for publishers everywhere. There have been quite a few scandals. But in the past, when I've talked to book editors, I've been surprised by the rates they're paid and the length of time given to projects. And publishers will actually admit, we don't do enough fact-checking, it's too costly, it's too time-consuming, we rely on the author for that. Now, when a smaller new publishing house run by some ex-journalists had sent me to South Africa a few years ago for almost 3 weeks to re-interview an elderly woman because they wanted to publish her wonderful but very fuzzy memoirs, editors and publishers from the big houses had almost looked down their noses when I told them about it. I can remember one editor saying to me patronisingly, oh, we never talk to the authors, before also telling me that few editors had time to fact check. And I listened very humbly. I mean, I was the journalist, she was the expert in the business, not me. But I secretly thought to myself, what a load of old cobblers. And now as I worked with what the lawyers were telling me, it seemed that somewhere along the line, someone had forgotten to do the most basic fact check on Ishmael's book, the date around which his whole narrative was built. And it's actually not that hard to check, by the way, because Sierra Rutile is one of the big mines in Sierra Leone. All you have to do is type in the name of the mine, type in rebels, and up it comes. The date comes in. And I did that thing of trying to prove that it actually had happened in 1993, and I couldn't. I went through archives. I went through. I did endless interviews. I went to the State Library. I consulted contemporaneous reports. It happened in 1995. So I was also puzzled by the attitude of the Americans. And the truth is, it rubbed up my nose too, and it made me suspicious. And it still does. So anyhow, eventually over a period of about 6 months, from late November through December to early January, I got my research and rough story up to a point where the Australian felt justified in putting two of its foreign correspondents onto it to do the on-the-ground reporting. This had always been part of the deal, that that had to happen. One in New York, David Nason, and the Europe correspondent, Peter Wilson. Between them, they've done fantastic reporting. On January 17, Peter flew into Sierra Leone and within a few hours had established that the father angle didn't pan out, but the timeline discrepancy definitely stacked up. The events definitely took place in 1995. Our first big story of almost 5,000 words ran that weekend. And over the next fortnight, Peter wrote a series of stories, pulling apart Beer's narrative, even finding a document, a school report, that placed him in school when he said he was already out on the road running for his life. Beer has also written about a deadly fight that had taken place when he first went into the rehab centre in the country's capital, Freetown, after being taken out of the army. Now, it's a key scene in his book, and it's so vivid and shocking that is often quoted in stories. The New York Times featured it when it ran a very large extract. Now, this fight is between rival child soldiers who accidentally meet at the camp. Six of them are killed. One has his eye gouged out with a bayonet. The victorious children, including Beer, are jubilant. But we can't find any official record that this fight ever took place. Not from UNICEF, not from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or the local Ministry of Social Welfare, Gender and Children's Affairs. And if such a fight had happened, it would have been a really big deal. Six deaths in an officially run camp. It would have been recorded. And also local correspondents and reporters would have remembered it. A few weeks ago, UNICEF actually told the Village Voice that no, it could not confirm Beer's account of the brawl that left six dead. Although I hasten to say that UNICEF remains very loyal to Beer and his accounts. Now, every time we made a finding like that, and that was an extraordinary one, we would go back to Farah Strauss's jury or direct to Sarah Crichton and ask for comment. And every time they'd say the same thing. They stood by Ishmael Beer's book. To this day, they still will not accept, publicly at least, the fact that the attacks on the mine in Mogwewa and then Matrujong happened in 95, not 93. And Beer keeps saying things like, oh, I didn't mean that invasion, I meant another one. But he has been so specific in his description of that series of attacks, right down to the appearance of a Catholic priest who had been captured by rebels and sent into Matrujong with a warning. Beer says, well, the rebels often use similar methods, a kind of formula, so this was a coincidence. But the intrepid Peter Wilson actually tracked that Catholic priest down. His name is Moses Saukele, and he's the Catholic Education Secretary. And he told Peter, there is no coincidence at all, because this only happened once, in 1995. I know because it was me. And it was just impossible for it to have happened to any other priest in 1993. I was the only priest in the region from 1991 to November 1995. Now, when Peter had told me he'd found the Catholic priest, the very priest who had figured in Beer's own account, albeit at a different date, we were both elated. By this stage, we'd had almost a solid fortnight of not just denials from FSG, Crichton and Beer, but attacks. We'd been accused of distortion, unethical conduct, harassment. We'd had to issue our own statement correcting the record on this. And yeah, I remember it was a Friday evening in late January when Peter rang me about the Catholic priest. I don't think he had been to bed for the previous 20 or so hours. He was riding out of London. And I remember him saying, what else do we have to do to prove our case? They won't be able to deny this. Well, you know what? They did. This is what appeared in Slate.com when it did a story on the controversy in early March. The reporter writes, when I asked Crichton if the conflicting accounts by the Catholic priest, who said he witnessed the only attack on Matrujong in 1995, gave her pause, that maybe the book fudged at least some of the timeline, Crichton said no, that she believed Beer's narrative to be true. I think I've seen seals with less slither. But the Americans are fiercely protective of Beer, and I would suggest protective of what his book has done for their careers and reputations. A lot of people have done very well out of this book. Sarah Crichton only joined FSG in 2004, and this book has been made her imprint. Beer's agent is Ira Silverberg. In early 2006, he was much embarrassed when another of his clients, J.T. Leroy, someone he had defended hotly, was unmasked as a hoaxer. Any questioning of Beer must worry him. Then there's the college creative writing professor Dan Cheon, who first talked Beer into revealing that the pretty gruesome short stories he was writing in his class were actually based on real-life experiences. Beer had kept that secret until then. He had never talked about it with his friends. And Cheon was the first person to work closely with Beer on his manuscript, meeting once or twice a week, going through the manuscript line by line. And at one stage, the professor told a college journal, I still think about moments when I'd say things like, the scene where the kid dies needs to be more vivid. And Chan says to the journal, I know there's something monstrous about that, but he got closer and closer to his emotional truths. The final manuscript from the college was close to 400 pages long in typescript. It was then offered to a few agents who turned it down. Then it got to Ira Silverberg, who then sold it to Sarah Crichton in 2005. Crichton, who has been a ghostwriter before, a co-writer in other books, including Marion Pearl's memoir, A Mighty Heart, then met Beer every Monday for almost a year, discussing the book and refining it. It's now come down to about half its original size. So at this stage, when you hear all of this, you can't help thinking, just who wrote this book? Who shaped this book? Under what kind of direction was Beer writing? And when was the timeline decided? And by who? And why? Chan told our New York reporter David Nason that he couldn't remember seeing any dates in the memoir at the time he was helping Beer with it. And he says that he would have remembered if there had been dates. In the Village Voice article, Neil Boothby, a highly regarded expert on children and war at Columbia University, a man who's worked with child refugees in Rwanda, Mozambique and Darfur, questions the fact that Beer's account happens to include just about every possible trauma that can occur in the bleak life of a child soldier. That it would be extraordinary for all of those horrible events to happen in the life of a single person. Boothby also commented on something else which the three of us at The Australian had discussed often: the pressure on such people to tell exaggerated stories. Boothby said the most sensational accounts tend to get the most attention. Orphans fleeing the Khmer Rouge, who had the most horrific stories, for example, tended to be resettled much more quickly than other refugees. Now, Ira Silverberg is adamant that Beer was never encouraged to jazz up his account. In fact, he told me that my suggestion that that might have happened was offensive. Possibly not quite as offensive as I found his description of us being effing muckraking hacks, but that's by the by. So if Beer wasn't being tempted to tell a few porkies and thus make his book even more marketable, what were his publishers doing to make sure that his story was accurate? Well, as far as we can ascertain from our own research, not that much. Although Crichton assured me in a letter that the book had been, quote, significantly vetted. Now, you have to ask yourself at this stage, how can all these sane people in these high-powered, responsible jobs keep denying that the sun comes up every morning? We have given them absolutely conclusive evidence. Well, you know why? Because as with all examples of bad behaviour, they are doing it because they can. They're getting away with it because they are being allowed to get away with it. I know I've cited the Village Voice's cover story several times, and that's had a big impact, and I've just mentioned Slate.com. But for the most part, the established American media have treated this story the way party guests might treat an interloper who's just drunk all the rum punch and then thrown up on the floor. They've delicately stepped around it and pretended it wasn't happening. Even the New York Times, which ran such a massive excerpt from the book, supposedly fact-checked by their own people, an extract which, by the way, included the fight that we've discovered never happened, they've mysteriously failed to cover our allegations except to run Beer's statement dismissing them. And this is supposed to be one of the world's most serious papers of record. Now, there are actually, I think, several reasons for this po-faced denial of the bleeding obvious. First, many illustrious Americans and American journals have been caught with their pants down. Secondly, Farrar, Straus & Giroux is a very prestigious publishing house, and most human beings don't like taking on powerful industries. I think there's also an element of what I would call a kind of reverse racism. People don't want to be seen to be criticising someone who has supposedly been through terrible things and who was a black African. Africa is a continent right now which is much in the news because of the war on poverty, the genocide in Sudan, Mugabe, and the attention to stars like Bono, Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt, George Clooney. It might be okay to criticise James Frey or the latest fabricator, Margaret Seltzer, but to criticise young Ishmael Beer could look uncool and lead to accusations of racism. And more seriously, it might damage Beer's work. Boothby actually said this. Although he felt the book exaggerated, and he had noticed that from the beginning, he said, "I've refrained from any sort of comment or criticism because I would hate to see something like this undermine the human rights momentum." And Boothby's attitude is seen often in the blogs, and I know it's well meant, but it does disturb me. Would we have said the same if, say, in 1955, someone had done the same thing with an account of his time in Auschwitz or any other concentration camp, exaggerated his time there by 1,000%, made up incidents? Would we have said, "Oh, it doesn't matter, one Holocaust survivor is the same as any other Holocaust survivor"? I don't think so. That would have been atrocious, unthinkable. But that's what does seem to be happening here. Now, from the very beginning, all FSG would have had to do for this to go away is to take responsibility and say that it intended to insert a small acknowledgement or preface or disclaimer into any new editions, and especially the new paperback edition in the US. But Crichton has said there will be no such concession. She told Slate, "There will be absolutely not a disclaimer. A disclaimer is used when you say I've changed names. He hasn't. Moved locales. He hasn't. So no, there will not be a disclaimer." I was talking very recently to a very senior Sierra Leonean. His background is the mining industry. We were talking about the elasticity of truth, especially in places like Sierra Leone, where people are still just trying to survive each day and where there is a strong storytelling tradition. Now, Sierra Leone's infrastructure, which wasn't much, it's always been a very, very poor country in spite of its amazing resources, its infrastructure was devastated during the war. Even Freetown still doesn't have 24 hours of electricity. Medical services, education are minimal. But the people are determined to rebuild their country. There's a wonderful movement at the moment. There's such a diaspora of Sierra Leoneans overseas that they're asking people to come back to the country or at least send money. They're really determined. They call themselves Salone, the Sweet Salone. And they talk about Sweet Salone. But when the two of us were talking about this, and about how if you want to restore infrastructure and get the schools and hospitals established, you do need truth. It's not some abstract notion to be debated over a couple of lattes in an inner city cafe. When somebody says the water supply to the villages has been put in place, you want to know that that's true. If somebody says they've delivered the wiring to a hospital so they can have power, you want to know that that's true. You want to know that the prices you've been quoted are true. In these circumstances, truth is not a luxury, it's a necessity. Truth is what keeps our society on the level. We need it. Without truth and an appreciation of truth, how do we know what to believe? How do we know who or what to trust? Without the rigour of truth, people get away with things. Now, there's one postscript worth mentioning as I finish. Ishmael Beer has announced that his next book will definitely be fiction. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Many thanks, and thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this fine facility again. And so we come to questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock, but maybe a bit before. Our 9-year-old hasn't returned.
She's watching outside.
Yeah. Just before I go to Anne, who were you suggesting actually wrote the book? You think it was probably a collected work, do you?
I think that what...
If you just talk to the back of the room.
Yeah, I think that what might have happened, and I have to say this is all conjecture, from the very beginning, when Ishmael Beer... I mean, and by the way, we do know that he's a very good student. When we found those school records, he was number 2 in his class, and he did very, very well in English, and people talk about him as being a brilliant chap. That's how they describe him. From the moment he actually turned up in that rehab camp, every time he told someone something that he had done that was terrible, he got rewarded. He'd get a Walkman, or people would say, oh, you poor thing. And so he must have thought this is a bit odd. The worse his stories were, the worse his behaviour, the more he got rewarded. And that just kept on happening all the way through. So I think what might have happened is that he was encouraged to embroider. We actually had that professor saying, well, you know, I told him to get to his emotional truth and make it more vivid. Now, I don't know how that, when you give that instruction to an impressionable 17 or 18-year-old, how that comes across. And then, of course, he's actually working with people like Sarah Crichton, who's been a ghostwriter. He's working with a creative writing professor. And don't forget, his guardian is a storyteller as well. It feels to me like a perfect storm, that everything's been encouraged and they've gotten themselves into it so much that maybe they're not even sure how they go back. I am perplexed, though, as why they didn't acknowledge that date at the very beginning, because if they had, it's pretty easy just to put an acknowledgement up the front. And because of that, that makes me want to pursue it. Who else knows what's really going on behind the surface? I mean, that's why I'm a journalist. That's why we keep on digging things out.
This isn't the sort of first case of this. And I wonder why it hasn't blown up more. I can't think of who the writer was. There was a woman who fabricated her life story and then to Australia and went back to America.
And Norma Currie.
Yeah, there was the infidel woman.
Yes.
Now, this is going on all the time. I'm surprised that the publishers have been able to get away with it.
No, I'm pretty surprised too.
Because there's a lack of interest, because these others have happened before, and now we're getting to a point where, well, what the heck, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that's not quite factually correct, but look, it's entertainment, you know, after all, Sierra Leone's had a really bad time, so what the heck if it's not actually factoid, truthful?
I think there's a lot of that.
Are we getting now to the slippery slide where we'll see a lot more of this?
Well, I think, I don't think so, because of what's just happened over two recent scandals. But I think you're right that there was that very much that sense of what does it really matter? And I talked to a lot of the journalists from the trade publications in New York. At one stage, I was actually almost acting as a kind of PR for the story, because we were very keen for the American media to pick it up, because we knew that they had resources that we wouldn't have. And I remember one of them emailing me just saying, oh, so Beer told a tall tale. Big yawn. But it doesn't quite stack up, because when those two latest scandals happened, there's the woman who I refer to her, Margaret. Her real, she said her name was Margaret Jones, and she was supposed to have been a half Indian, Native Indian foster child who'd been fostered by a family in the LA gangland wars. And then it turned out she'd actually had a very wealthy upbringing in Sherman Oaks, and she'd actually fought her publishers for 3 years, and Penguin had to pull the book. And there's also the woman who was supposed to have lived with wolves who escaped from the Holocaust, and then it turned out she wasn't even Jewish, let alone someone who knew how to live with wolves. Now those two scandals have gotten a lot of attention, but this one hasn't. And when I was talking to a Sierra Leone journalist, he said to me, you know, I think, and I guess this is the thing I've always thought deep down, he said, I think the Americans didn't like the fact that you discovered this. You're Australians. They didn't like that. And I mean, the Slate.com piece is really interesting because it's very thorough, and I'm very pleased that it did give us oxygen, and it went on for quite a long time, and there's a lot of back and forth, and he spent 2 hours on the phone with me, and accepted. Towards the end of the 2 hours, I said, hey, I just realised I'm paying for this call. but what was interesting about that is we amassed all our evidence, you know, the Catholic priests, there were chieftains, there was a former government minister, there were the people in the village, there were, and against that, we had Sarah Crichton just saying, well, I've talked to people in Sierra Leone. And in spite of that, he still said, he said, she said, he said, she said. So the three of us actually sent him quite a stroppy email to say, and I did say to him, what would our witnesses have had to be for you to have taken them seriously? Would they have had to be Americans? Would they have had to be white Americans? And this guy, I think, would regard himself as progressive left, but I do think in this story, I do see a lot of a kind of ugly racism that these people would say, no, no, we're not racist, but there is. There's something about this story, but I think also it's overlaid by the fact that we're just Australians. How dare we discover this?
I
was wondering if you could elaborate on your comment that Ishmael Bia had a photographic memory.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because the photographic memory is really interesting. It turns up on page 51 of his book. He talks about what a photographic memory he has. And by that, I think he means not the literal translation, which means you look at a book and you remember it goes straight into your head. I mean, it means that he always has like a videotape memory. And he talks about, or has talked about this very, very often in his interviews. He would almost boast about it. But what's really interesting is now, when Peter went to that that conference in London and asked those tough questions, for the first time, Bia did not say he had a photographic memory. He said, oh, the events in the book are true as far as my memory can remember it. And when he says that, he means his memory being like your memory and my memory. And this is a 180-degree turn, but nobody's picked up on it. He gets away with a lot.
I have two questions. In your opinion, if Ishmael came out fairly early on and admitted that there was a bit of a fabrication and, you know, positioned it, and I'm sure you would have had a right PR position, do you think he could have continued to champion a child, you know, born child?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, because it's right in front of our faces. I mean, well, there are 300,000 kids caught up in it.
So his credibility wouldn't have been undermined, still would have been able to...
Well, the thing is, he had a letter out very easy. He was very young when this happened. He didn't have a notebook with him. He was on drugs. I mean, those kids were all on drugs. It would have been so easy to have said, I'm a bit fuzzy about all of this. I think the problem is the 2 years versus the 2 months. That's quite a big jump. But I do think if he had come out and said, and in fact, at the very beginning, I didn't say this in the piece, my speech was already quite long, that at one stage I almost stopped being a freelance journalist. I was so keen for these people just to talk to Bob Lloyd, just to hear what he had to say. And if they had, then none of this would have actually happened. But they wouldn't. I actually sent emails to them saying, look, just here's Bob's number, just pick up the phone. And obviously I was wanting them to talk about both angles. But all they had to do, if they'd done that, if they just talked, if they found it, it would have been so easy to fix. They could have just wiped that off, and that wouldn't have bothered me. I mean, it would have been a very civilised way to have handled it. And I don't think for a minute that it would have affected his position. I mean, last November, as I said, UNICEF made him that advocate. UNICEF wouldn't have backed... Nobody would have backed away from him. I mean, they're not backing away from him now, so they certainly wouldn't have backed away then.
And the second question, what are you going to do next with the story?
I've got lots of files, And I have to tell you that I'm actually going to Germany in June, and I was driving along with someone who's very close to me, and I've got about a month of travelling after that, and he suddenly said to me, "You're not thinking of going to Sierra Leone, are you?" Mm-hmm. I said, "Why would you think that?" And he said, "Well, you know, but look, I think it's very hard to walk away from something like this. I have still been putting calls in, although I do think because of that storytelling tradition, and also because, well, what's really in it? I mean, for the people who grew up with Ishmael in his village, maybe relatives, what's really in it for them to harm him? I mean, they must perceive that if he's not telling the truth, then if they tell the truth, that's going to harm him. So what's really in it for them? So it may end up being one of those stories you can't really get to the end. But at, for this stage, I certainly don't want to leave it alone. I'm just intrigued. And I do want this to keep going back, not to Ishmael Beer, but to the publishers, because I think it's the publishers who have masterminded this.
Right down the back.
I compliment you on your book. I think you've done a fabulous job. I lived in that area, in Guinea, the country next door, and used to visit Sierra Leone for holidays, wonderful holidays before all of this problem.
Yeah.
I wonder if your quest for the truth is something that culturally they just don't have the same concept as we do.
I think you're right on that.
Truth is not always important. I knew in my job I had that problem all the time. But secondly, they're not set a very good example. You've got the publishers who have got their own vested interests, but politically, we've had similar sort of situations here and in the United States. I don't think it should be a surprise that people can tell stories and get away with them.
Well, I agree with you about the fact that there's that elasticity which I referred to, but what bothers me is the publisher's role in this. And also what bothers me is, why did this story have to be exaggerated? Wasn't it enough for us that it was 2 months? Why did it have to be 2 years? That's the thing I don't like. There are a lot of these books now coming out of Africa and Asia. You know, I was a Cambodian sex slave. I was this. And it feels to me as if we're exploiting them all over again. So they may not care about the truth, and that's fair enough. Well, you know, if something comes out, it's a collection of stories or whatever. But we know that a memoir and non-fiction is supposed to be the truth. So we can't just suddenly cherry-pick their culture and apply it to our books. So it's much more the Western. But I do agree with you in what you're saying, but to me it's about the Western attitudes here that I find a bit whiffy.
Okay, so question here and then over down the back there. Yeah.
What do you suggest should be done to prevent such type of false publications? Because we have had several in the last few years. I mean, the job to check all facts are almost impossible.
Look, the publishers will always say they don't have enough time, they don't have... And I've just done a piece about truth for the latest issue of Australian Author, which I think is out any minute. And in it, I actually sent an email to a publisher who said, come up with this kind of thing, oh, it's too time-consuming, we can't cost it. And I just said, look, if you can't produce books to the right standard, then maybe the business model is wrong. I think these kinds of stories really help, that you're pushing them along all the time to the fact that... But people are very frank about it. Louise Adler, you know, the head of MUP, said, look, we know we don't check the facts. What we're thinking about is, does that manuscript speak to our heart? And they're not from a journalistic tradition, but the thing is, it's non-fiction. And what's so worrying at the moment is that this kind of non-fiction, this kind of memoir, is very popular at the moment with the readers. So the only thing we can do is be vigilant. And the best thing we can do is not say, oh, why does it matter? Why does it matter? Does it matter? Does it matter?
How far do you think Ishmael Beer is a prisoner?
Look, I don't know. That's the thing I want to find out. I don't know. When I started off, I was very much just thinking about that this is somebody who's fallen into Western hands, basically. But he has been so adamant in his own defence of his book. And he now is 27. I mean, people refer to him as a kid, but Ishmael Beer is now 27. You know, he's a man. And when he was writing this, he was in his 20s. So I don't know. I mean, I do think that he's certainly been encouraged along the way. And I do feel sorry for him. It does feel to me that he's been encouraged all along the way, and then suddenly he's in the spotlight. And maybe he just feels, I'm in so deep, and
Is it pressure?
Is it pressure? Oh, well, I don't know. I wouldn't be able to say that.
Question down there.
Do you think there's a double standard when it comes to people publishing
fake material, because when Helen, that Aussie author, Helen Demidenko, or Helen Darby, which is her real name, when she published her book and it found out it was fake, there was a huge brouhaha and lots of media coverage, and that she was condemned and so on. But he seems to be getting away with telling things that aren't true without much scrutiny.
Look, that's my own feeling about why this is happening. And he's very charismatic, and that fact that he looks like a child is, I think, quite I think that's quite captivating. But that is something that always worries me. Are the standards level, or are we? Because I guess it's what's actually happened up in the north of our own country. The double standard there means that's why we're in such crisis. Why the Aborigines are in such crisis today? It's that kind of, what do you call it, the reflex, it's political correctness, I suppose. So I do think there might be an element of that.
As you'd be aware, in the Helen Darville case, she copped a lot of criticism from a lot of commentators, but in literary circles, not so much criticism. Look, we've got to be very quick to your question then.
The creative writing professor at Oberlin College, Sharon, he seems to be the weakest link, the one that has come closest to spilling the beans on this. You were asked where does the story go from here. Would he be the point of pressure?
No, absolutely not. Dan Cheon, after we published that piece, I was going through the blogs and going regularly, and then suddenly there's a piece on a blog from Dan Chan saying, well, someone had commented on the story, and then Dan Chan writes to this blogger saying, look, I was just seriously misquoted there, and then he actually says, look, this is what my transcript was and this is what had happened. Well, what he didn't know was that David Nason had taped his interview. So David then wrote to Dan Chan saying, look, mate, you know, this is the way David talks to you. I've been in this business for 30 years. I've never had someone that do that to me, but look, this is what you say in your transcript. This is the actual transcript. And he asked Dan Cheon to apologise, to make sure that blog came down. And Dan Cheon just didn't respond. By the way, this is their favoured method. They either attack or they simply don't respond. But I was very pleased to see that blogger has now changed that entry, because it was up there for ages. Because once Slate.com, if you go to Slate.com, Ishmael Beer, the story is there, and that reporter did actually go into quite intensive detail about Dan Cheon and his allegations and then David Nason's rebuttal. But then again, it's almost as if people will start telling the truth at the beginning and then they all close up. And that's even happened with some of the people I've talked to in Sierra Leone by phone, that they will be quite open, and suddenly, no, it's closed up, and it feels like somebody talks to them, somebody gets to them, somebody says, look, this is not a good idea.
Question on Sebastian.
Julie, is there any actual evidence of him actually being a child soldier, or evidence that he was not a child soldier? Or anything that you may not be able to put on record at the moment, but you said you continue to investigate?
Look, this is something I'm investigating. It's a very hard one to prove, because most of the child soldiers are dead or have been rehabilitated or suffered a huge trauma. But Janice Hereda, who's an American book critic, has got a website called 1 Minute Book Reviews, and she was one of the only people I ever saw actually question at the very beginning Ishmael Beer's book. And she kept on asking things like, well, how could he have overheard that conversation at the campfire? Wouldn't they have heard him? And when I talked to her recently, she said to me, I'm yet to see any proof that he ever was a child soldier. Now, the thing is, when you conjecture like that, and we're just doing it open like this, I want you to make absolutely sure it's just conjecture. It's not, it's just hypothesis. But I do think it is a little odd that at this stage, nobody has come out to say, well, I fought with him, I remember him. I mean, there is a famous child soldier called Kabla Williams, I think his name is, and he has said that he believes that Ishmael was a child soldier in 1995. But I think that question of whether he ever was, and there are whispers about that on the blog, but again, that's why I'm quite tempted to go to Sierra Leone myself.
Final question over there. Yeah.
Yeah, my question is, now you said somebody was his father, for instance, in your speech. Have you checked that
No, that's the whole point. We didn't report that. Yeah. The reason why when I took this story to the Australian and said, look, this is what I've got up so far, the reason it was always done on the deal that I could only take the work, the book, the story so far, and then they would have to send someone to Sierra Leone, and of course we'd have to get somebody in New York. No, that's a very mysterious thing as well, which I don't want to talk about that much, but no, the when our reporter got there, it didn't pan out. I don't believe the man was a hoaxer. I mean, it may be something in the Sierra Leonean tradition. He says, or his wife says, oh no, he's actually the cousin. There's something a bit blurry. Anyhow, I don't want to talk about that. So, but no, we never reported that because to all intents and purposes at that time, the man said he wasn't the father. Us having got there and having, him having said he was.
No, I'll
talk to you after.
My question was simply about what did the father say about whether his son had ever been a child soldier?
Well, because I'm sure it is the father.
That's right. So.
Well, the thing is, they wouldn't have seen each other because he was evacuated. He actually ran into the bush. The mine was evacuated. The locals mostly disappeared into the bush. He went into the bush until about 1996. And then in 1998, he did go to Freetown to try and find Ishmael. He'd heard that Ishmael was in Freetown. This is the story before we... You know, this is the person who says he was the father. And by that stage, Ishmael had left. But the father wouldn't know anything about this because they were separated. Once the rebels went in there, they lost contact. That's how Ishmael lost his lost his family.
But that was 1995. What does the father remember of 1993?
Oh, no, I mean, the father was the one who said this didn't happen in
1993. Well, are you
going to
bring the father out and get him to come and tell
you everything? I mean,
this could be the next big blockbuster.
Yeah, I mean, that would be good.
Yeah.
The father's story.
Yeah. I better call the name to go on. We could have the father
addressed
the Sydney Interview.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, no, but that is...
But, Anne, you're actually right in that, because there are three...
There are three
fake years here. There are 3 years that he says... There's actually 1 year.
Yes.
There's 1 year where he might have spent 2 months as a child soldier, and the question from the back of the room was, well, was he ever a child soldier? Possibly for 2 months, possibly not at all. As for the 93-94, no. He was in, as far as the father's concerned, he was in school.
That's right.
The teachers say he was in school.
This is the story.
Oh, yes, this is definitely the story. Do you want to come to Sierra Leone with me? Because I don't want to go on my own.
We could go on all night, but we're not going to. Look, it's been a great story, and I think it's a story that will continue.
Thank you, Jared.
And at the Institute, we do believe that truth matters, and I think it's very important that Chilligeer came along, told us about a story. It'd be great to publish it, but it's not the end of the story, and perhaps there's other time to bring it back. But I think your commitment to the truth on this is very important. I think you've done extremely well, so has the Australian, and it's important to record what we know. So we're delighted that you could do it here, and you've been here before, and no doubt to be back again. But tonight, many thanks. And
thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.